Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about adrenal fatigue. It is epidemic in our society. And essential rescue and recovery tips. Some good information in the current issue of Natural Society. Defective telomeres are now linked to dozens of diseases and many types of cancers. And this is important because if you live a lifestyle that can extend the length of your telomeres, you're going to live a longer life. You'll be healthier. But you can't do it in a token way and expect good outcome. So we'll get into this in some length. And by the way, just the telomeres are what attaches to your chromosomes. Just imagine shoestrings and that little plastic tip that keeps your shoestrings from unraveling. That would be considered the telomeres. So we'll deal with that. There's some amazing benefits to tamarind for your skin and your hair and your health. We'll share that. And also, music therapy can help heal neurological diseases, and a popular flowering herb acts as a natural stress vaccine. So we have a lot to share with you. Then we're going to do an in-depth look at GMOs, continuing our consumer health report on why we should say no to all GMOs. But we have something added today. We have a plant biologist who's written an editorial for Counterpunch. His name is Jonathan Latham, and he is now one of the scientists working in the field who has doubts about their safety and efficacy. So I'll share his comments. My guest in the second part of our program will be Russ Baker. He is a multi-award-winning investigative journalist, and for the past 20 years, he's covered a lot of major investigations, the Hutu Tutsi massacres in Rwanda, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the overthrow of the Romanian dictator. He's received Society of Professional Journalism awards, the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism faculty. He has got a lot to say, and we're going to take an honest look at Katrina. I've been watching some of the clips and from the mainstream media celebrating Katrina, and here is the problem. They're not telling you the truth. Now, maybe they don't know the truth. I'm not ascribing motive. I'm not saying it's political. But for those who've done their homework and looked in depth, this was more than a Category 5 hurricane. This was corruption in FEMA and the political arena we're going to explore with Russ Baker. Also today, time permitting, we're going to have a short piece from Greg Palast to commemorate the anniversary of Katrina. Chemotherapy doesn't work 97% of the time, yet why is it advocated almost 97% of the time? Surgery, yes, but chemotherapy and radiation, constantly. Also, the power of empathy. We're going to explore that. And George Carlin has something to say about, well, we just seem to be over-consuming everything. I don't know how much we'll get of all this, but we'll try. Let's begin. When you see how tired most people are, it's a puzzle. And like any puzzle, you want to see if you can take each of the pieces apart, examine them, and then see where do they fit. And with a lot of people, they suffer from fatigue, but it has nothing to do with viruses. It's not chronic fatigue syndrome. It's not an Epstein-Barr virus. It's not a cytomegalovirus. Instead, it's the adrenal glands. And when you examine the adrenal glands and you test their strength, you find that they're running on empty. And that's because every time you are stressed, no matter what the cause, legitimate or not, you pump adrenaline. You pump other hormones as well, stress hormones like cortisol, epinephrine, norepinephrine, catecholamines. So we end up exhausted. We walk around, and a lot of people don't connect their exhaustion with their thyroid condition. That can cause fatigue. Anxiety causes fatigue. Depression causes fatigue. Being overweight causes fatigue. Not exercising can cause fatigue. So there's a lot of things that can cause adrenal fatigue. All of these I just mentioned are part of it. So you have to understand the endocrine system a little bit, because the endocrine system must be put back into balance in order for you to heal. And the adrenals are very small, but boy, they are powerful. They are two very tiny glands, and they sit just on top of your kidneys. They keep cortisol and adrenaline in balance. Now, those are your primary stress hormones, but they're also important for our metabolism. For example, they regulate inflammation in the body. You need to have them working, because if you have something that you should be inflaming about, which is part of the healing process, you want to turn that on. But you also don't want it to stay on, because inflammation is chronic, shortens your lifespan, kills organs. And also, your adrenal glands produce aldosterone, which helps control blood pressure. So almost always when you meet someone and you're speaking with them and you're getting a history, you find that if they have adrenal exhaustion, more often than not, they have blood pressure problems. So just imagine that the adrenals are constantly going on and producing based upon stresses throughout the day. They're just exhausted. And the adrenals modulate a process initiated by the sympathetic nervous system when our body encounters a threatening situation. The hormones of the adrenal medulla contribute to this response. Now, hormones secreted by the adrenal medulla are epinephrine. By the way, epinephrine is the hormone that's more commonly known as adrenaline. And adrenaline is made by your adrenals. And it responds instantaneously to any kind of stress, but it also increases your heart rate. It rushes blood to your muscles. It rushes blood to your brain. And that's why in the middle of the night, you're sleeping soundly, and suddenly you hear a sound. Instantly, you're up. Your vision has become acute. All your body senses are acute. It also brings your blood sugar level up so that you can convert instantly glycogen, which is your stored glucose, to glucose, which is active. And it also creates norepinephrine, and which is also called noradrenaline. And that hormone works with epinephrine to respond to stress. And it can cause vasoconstriction, the narrowing of the blood vessels. And that gives you high blood pressure. So when the adrenals are not doing the right thing, then you have too much cortisol that will age you and kill you prematurely. And you have adrenaline in your body, and that's bad. So you have stages of this that you go through. Now, how would you know? Because sometimes you can have multiple causes for the same condition. If you have body aches, but you haven't been exercising in that area, depression, irritability, the need for coffee, that caffeine rush. If you feel just tired, though you've gotten plenty of sleep, if you can't go to sleep or you have trouble waking up, if you have low libido, if you have blood sugar imbalances, if you can't concentrate, if you get dizzy when you stand up too quickly, if you have food cravings, especially salt and sugar, then you can pretty much estimate that your adrenals are shot. So what would be some of the things that we can do in a good way? What is the good message in this story. First and foremost, throw away all of your excess sugar, all of your processed grains. That means your processed pastas, white flour products, white sugars. Get rid of all of them. Get rid of caffeine and coffee completely. Get rid of all of the instant foods that you make, because more often than not, they're junk. And that will help cause the blood sugar to level out. And those spikes in blood sugar and insulin are almost always impacting adrenaline. Start bringing in the good fats into your diet. The good fats. Walnut. That's a good fat. Coconut. That's excellent. Olives. Terrific. Almonds. Avocados. Those are all good fats. And get rid of the margarine. And get rid of the soybean oil, the corn oil, the cottonseed oil, the peanut oil. Get rid of them. Make sure that when you go to bed at night, you actually turn off all electric. Meaning, you turn off your computer, not just turn off the screen, but turn the entire hard drive off. Also, unplug your television from the wall. Because if you don't, you've just turned off the screen, but all of the electronic is still pulsating, and that can cause an overstimulation in the body. Take out the battery from your cell phone. Don't allow any digital clock within 6 feet of your head, because that digital clock at night is pulsing an electromagnetic pulse right into your brain. So cell phones, computers, tablets, turn them off completely. Also, make sure that your room is completely dark. And if you need earplugs, use them. If you need an soft eye patch to put over your eye, do so. Deep, controlled breathing has a very positive effect upon the adrenals. That's why meditation and yoga are good for your adrenals. Have a rainbow of food and juices every day. Start your day with two fresh lemons or lime, and then a grapefruit juice, fresh made, and put in there some vitamin C, which is terrific for your adrenals also, and pantothenic acid, which is terrific for your adrenals, magnesium and calcium at 1,000 milligrams of citrate, and then some green apple juice, 100 milligram B-complex, and drink that down. That rejuvenates your adrenals. Also, green tea throughout the day. You can make some wonderful eucalyptus green tea or lemongrass green tea, which is iced tea, which is very, very good. And just take time for easy adrenal relaxing exercises. Yoga, meditation, power walking, those are all good for you. And also spend some time with nature. Don't use artificial stimulants. Don't overtrain till you're exhausted. And make sure you're taking adequate amounts of DHEA. Because when your adrenal glands are not in balance, your DHEA level production will suffer greatly. You need DHEA, about 20 milligrams a day, because it creates all the hormones in your body. And don't forget the reishi, changa, C-H-A-N-G-A, or C-H-A-G-A, lion's mane, and cordyceps mushrooms. Those are all good for your adrenal glands. And there are certain adaptogenic herbs that help your body adapt to stressors. Ashwagandha, Panax ginseng, astragalus. Those are all great for adrenal health. You don't see very often. Generally in the fall, you'll see tamarind, TAMA, T-A-M-A, rind, R-I-N-D. It's wonderful for you. It's common to the Thai and Indonesian cuisines. Most Americans never even heard of it, let alone had it. It's a small tree. It's actually native to the African continent, but it's been cultivated in India and other parts of the Asian continent. And it's terrific. It's a sweet, sour fruit. You take off the skin, which is kind of almost like a cracker. That's the quality of the skin and consistency. And you'll see these little thin, look like wiry veins. And you just pull them back, so then you're left with the kind of sticky, like a stream bean. And that is what you make your tamarind, whatever it might be, from. And it's a superfood. It's extremely beneficial. And it has terrific properties. What does tamarind do? Because you could take like a teaspoon of it and put it into an iced tea and make a tamarind iced tea. And then put some, and how you put mint into a cold tea is take a handful of mint leaves, like spearmint, peppermint, and you crush them. Just roll them around in your hand. Then put them in the tea and stir them. That releases the oils. And the oils are what give the mint its wonderful flavor and aroma. So by combining the mint with the tamarind paste, by the way, in Indian stores and in Manhattan, they're down on Lexington Avenue, lower part of Lex, around the 17th Street. I've also seen from 18th, you have about six or seven, and you can get a whole giant can of the tamarind paste. And they don't have to be organic. Again, I'm gradually letting you know there are certain things that do not have to be certified organic because they're not sprayed and they have tough shells on them, and it's just not necessary. Tamarind's one of them. So get the paste. So you put a teaspoon of the paste into your mineral water with green tea and mint. Then throw ice in there, then blend it till it's almost like a slush. That is one of the most delicious, thirst-quenching things you can possibly have, but it also promotes good digestion. It's been used to help people who have constipation and who might not have enough bile getting in from the bile duct, so to help break down fats. It also helps if you have ulcers, stomach ulcers. It supports your heart health. In Ayurvedic medicine, it's used as a cardioprotective, normalizing fruit. It can lower cholesterol levels. It helps your skin and hair. It's great as a tonic for skin and hair. For the skin, it can reduce inflammation and irritation, and it's terrific for you, for your skin and hair. And it regulates blood sugar, so pre-diabetics and diabetics can have it. So that's our nutrient of the day. Now, most of my work dealt with how can we understand the aging process, slow it down, and wherever possible, reverse it. And what I figured out was that you have to extend the life of the telomeres that cap the chromosomes. So, for example, I had 1,000 mice, and these mice live a certain length of time. So I kept one as a control, so it had its normal life. The only difference was I'd never keep them in cages. I believe that was very inhumane. So they could just run free in this 3,000 square foot lab I had. And others were a different color, and they didn't have the standard diet. They would have fresh juices I would make every day, and they would have raw foods, like give them lots of sprouted beans and nuts and seeds. They had a ton of that, and they lived 25% average longer. And then you put music in, and you give them challenges. You hide the food, and they have to find the food. So challenging environment, and this is also true for humans, people frequently live very boring lives, and the only way they can get out of this boredom is by going on the internet or watching television. They choose not to make their life more challenging. Instead of, they look for substitutions, and that's not healthy. That's not how you live a longer life. So the more challenging your environment, and then caloric restrictions. So when you put it all together, if you don't have high caloric dense foods like butter and your trans fats and meat, those are high concentrations of calories. That will shorten your telomeres. When you're under a lot of stress, it shortens the telomeres. When you're not physically active, it shortens the telomeres. When you're in a very polluted environment, it shortens your telomeres. When you've been exposed to pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, it shortens the telomeres. When you've had a lot of sugar in the diet and caffeine, alcohol, smoking, shortens the telomeres. So you do just the opposite. And that's how you lengthen the telomeres. Now, this is from a major scientific study. I'll quote it. This is from the Centro Nacional Investigations of Oncology. Quote, studying telomeres, the structures that protect the ends of chromosomes, has become a key issue in biology. In recent years, not only has their relation to aging been confirmed, but defective telomeres seem to be linked to more and more illnesses, including many types of cancer. The review published by Dr. Paula Martinez and Maria Blasco in the Trends in Biochemical Sciences stresses the importance of investigating these structures to improve diagnosis and develop possible treatments for many diseases. Telomeres, in the opinion of these researchers, will become increasingly important in clinical studies. The chromosomes in every single cell are made up of DNA and shaped like strands with a kind of protective cap at the end of each strand of DNA. Without this end protective cap, the DNA strands would chemically bond to other strands, i.e. the chromosomes would merge, and that would be lethal for the cell. The structures that prevent this catastrophe are the telomeres. They were discovered in the 1930s, but decades elapsed before someone decided to study them in depth. And since the late 1990s, well, they weren't aware of my work in the 1970s, because for 25 years before anyone was researching them, I was doing all this research. But the biologists are often surprised by their amazing and unexpected complexity and their health-related significance. Quote, the biology of telomeres is extremely complex, and the more we discover, the more we realize what remains to be discovered. And then it goes on to talk about how they can cause cancer when you don't have them and they've been damaged. And they are correct. So now science is finally appreciating how important it is to have healthy telomeres, and yet as a nation, we're not doing that. The very things that shorten our telomeres, hence lead to disease and shorten our lifespan, those are our comforts. And we're not happy about changing anything that would make us feel uncomfortable. But there's one thing that they didn't say. Now, they were looking specifically at cancer. I want to play you a clip now. It's entitled, Chemotherapy Doesn't Work 97% of the Time. It's a short clip because just yesterday, I was speaking with Eutrice Lead. And Eutrice will be on the program in a few days. We're just having an independent, board-certified oncologist examine her first MRIs of her lungs and her uterus and her second set that was occurred just a couple weeks ago. And the doctors, after they looked at this, say, oh, good, now you're improving to where we can do some chemotherapy and surgery. And she asked the doctor, have you read my report, which is 90 pages long? And the answer was no. Well, then she said, why would you recommend a therapy like chemotherapy when you haven't read the report? And I've done my homework, and my homework shows that chemotherapy does not extend the lifespan of someone with stage 4B lung cancer. And the doctor simply said, well, you know, it's what we believe. Well, your belief doesn't count here. And once again, he is not trying to harm her. He would certainly like to see her do well. But for all the oncologists in America, there's two steps you have to take if you want to change. The first step is you have to take a step away from the limitations of your existing belief system. You have to walk a step away from the paradigm. But that's easier said than done, because with that paradigm comes your identity and your security, and frequently your reason for being, where people go in every day and give all the patients they see the same types of protocols. And if it doesn't work, they simply give them double the dose or higher dose. And only when it's clear to anyone, but almost last to the doctor, but first to the patient who sees it's not working and how they feel, some patients actually beg the doctor to stop the protocol. And then the doctor, who's not feeling in the pain, whose hair's not fallen out, who doesn't have stomach ulcers, mouth ulcers, who doesn't have neuropathy, doesn't have all the problems from the chemotherapy, will say, okay, we'll pull it down a notch, as if somehow we must never get too far away from the paradigm, least off we offend it. So now imagine 950,000 doctors who are intelligent, who care about their patients, but they haven't yet asked a fundamental question. Is the paradigm I'm a part of, the tools I'm using, likely to give me an outcome that justifies the effort I'm giving to the patient? And does the patient has a better chance of surviving? That's the step away you have to take. Once you do that, then you have to take a step towards being truly free to make an independent decision. So when two board-certified physicians came without letting anyone know to the retreats, and they saw a whole different way of working with people, and there were no drugs, there was no chemotherapy, no surgeries, no diagnosing, no treating, but enormous changes, changes they had never seen in their entire medical career, didn't think were possible. And we're not talking about over a year or 2 years, we're talking about in 1 week, sometimes in 2 to 3 days. Well, they could not answer this because there are no answers inside the existing paradigm. You have to go outside that paradigm to see what might be available. And so now they have a phenomena. We saw something, we investigated something, we spoke with people, and there's nothing that we have that can address this. And that's where we end up taking a look. And is there not a different way to be able to help people with the desire that medicine has, but not rewarding people for their efforts, but rather rewarding people with their results? Because if we rewarded medicine for its results, 88% of all physicians in the United States would be bankrupt. Listen in now to this piece on chemotherapy doesn't work 97% of the time.
Doctor, can we talk about cancer a little bit? Various types out there. What are some of the things that you've seen in terms of your patients, and what some of the things that you've been able to do?
A better thing to talk about in relationship to cancer, well, I will talk about that, right? A better thing to talk about, however, is the relationship between profits and cancer in the United States. There was a study that was published, I believe it was in 1994. It was a 12-year program, 12-year study. They looked at adults who had developed cancer as an adult, not childhood cancer, but adult cancer, right? And this is the main types of cancer that we get here in the United States. They did a meta-analysis of these people all around the world who developed cancer as adults for 12 years and were treated with chemo. And they looked at the results. And they published the results in the Journal of Clinical Oncology. And the results? 97% of the time, chemotherapy does not work. 97% of the time, it doesn't work. So why is it still used? It's one reason and one reason only: money. If you go to a medical doctor, an MD, with a sinus infection, and that doctor prescribes an antibiotic, he gets no financial kickback. Now, if he prescribes 5,000, you know, of that antibiotic in 1 month, the drug company that makes it might send him to Cancun for a conference, right? Mm-hmm. But he gets no direct remuneration. It's not with chemotherapeutic drugs, it's different. Chemotherapeutic drugs are the only classification of drugs that the prescribing doctor gets a direct cut of. So if your doctor prescribes chemotherapy for you, here's how it goes, more or less. The doctor buys it from the pharmaceutical company for $5,000, sells it to the patient for $12,000, insurance pays $9,000, and the doctor pockets the $4,000 difference. And there ought to be a law. The only reason chemotherapy is used is because doctors make money from it. Period. It doesn't work 97% of the time. If Ford Motor Company made an automobile that exploded 97% of the time, would they still be in business? No. This is the tip of the iceberg of the control that the pharmaceutical industry has on us. Most people have no idea of this at all. Now, I wrote a book. It's called The MD Emperor Has No Clothes, right? In my book, I have a bulleted list of 10 questions that every cancer patient should ask their doctor. 10 questions. I've had patients kicked out, literally, kicked out of the oncologist's office because the doctor was PO'd that the patient was asking them these questions. And these are just common sense questions. Cancer treatment in the United States, we have lost the war on cancer. We have lost the war on cancer. Why? Because cancer is not a reductionistic phenomenon. Cancer is a holistic phenomenon. And when you try to bring a reductionistic methodology like drugs and surgery to bear on a holistic phenomenon, you will completely miss the boat each and every time. You cannot do it. Medical doctors are like colorblind art critics. They can see that that's a boat. They can see the black and white outline, but they're completely blind to all of the colors and textures that make up the substance of the thing. It's no difference with cancer. The reason that people get cancer in the United States and the reason that we have completely lousy outcomes is because medical doctors are driving the research bus. When women get together and do a 5K run for breast cancer, all of that money, do you think any of that money goes to nutritional research? Do you think any of that money goes to homeopathic research or acupuncture or traditional Chinese medicine or naturopathic research? No. All of it goes to drugs and surgery, which do not work. Now, why aren't those women running for selenium? If every girl in this country took 200 micrograms of selenium, in one generation, we'd eliminate breast cancer by 82%. That's a big number. Why aren't we doing that? Because medicine in the United States is a for-profit industry, and most people are completely unaware of this, and most people bow down to the altar of MD-directed high-tech medicine at their own demise.
Okay. We're going to take a brief break and come back, and we have Russ Baker, our guest, to talk about a different look back at Katrina, a look back at government incompetence and criminal corruption. Please stay with us.
If you're fond of sand dunes and salty air, quaint little villages here and there, you're sure to fall in love with old Cape Cod, that old Cape Cod. If you like the taste of a lobster stew, served by a window with an ocean view, you're sure to fall in love with old Cape Cod.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. Let's now go to New York, where Russ Baker is standing by. I gave you his bio earlier on in the show. Let's say hello to Russ. Nice to have you back with us, Russ.
Hey, Gary, how you doing?
Good. Russ, Katrina was the largest and third largest hurricane ever recorded in U.S. history, and it arrived at a time when New Orleans levees could only handle a Category 3 storm. And while Katrina was a Category 5 with 175-mile-an-hour winds, it resulted in the largest population evacuation in U.S. history. It was also the costliest storm, with some estimates of over $150 billion. It left 1,900 people dead, mostly senior citizens, and millions were affected in some ways, such as loss of homes, jobs, and businesses and schools. And you might remember that the Bush administration initially tried to place all the blame for New Orleans' ill-preparedness on state officials, and particularly Louisiana Governor Blanco. But the truth is that Governor Blanco declared a state of emergency 3 days before the storm hit, long before the White House did, and while Bush was on one of his usual vacations. There were many pleas to FEMA for aid and support, which were either not responded to or only partially, such as the request to FEMA for 700 buses and then days later receiving just 100. And of course, it's impossible to stop a Category 5 hurricane, but it is within human means to be prepared and respond to it. And in the case of Katrina, which New Orleans has yet to fully recover from after 10 years, it was the utter incompetence of the Bush administration and the scandalous activities of FEMA officials under the Bush regime that contributed to the event being more disastrous than necessary. So provide us with an overview of how a noteworthy agency such as FEMA, which was created by Jimmy Carter to handle disaster relief operations, became an inept agency filled with GOP cronies with absolutely no experience for directing and overseeing FEMA missions. The form is yours.
Sure. Thanks, Gary. First of all, I got interested in this right when Hurricane Katrina happened, and I had gotten an assignment from Vanity Fair, and my mission was to try to understand where the failure happened. Now, one of the things I want to stress here is there's no question that there is blame to go around. There's no question that there were issues with how the mayor of New Orleans handled it. But the fact of the matter is that emergencies of this scale are national events. Hurricane Katrina affected the entire Gulf Coast and a number of states, and in some ways really affected the whole country. And any one state, any one city, of course, is going to be very uneven in terms of their prior experience with disasters or their capacity to handle them. And so this notion that it has really grown in this country of, you know, everything on the local or state level doesn't necessarily make a lot of sense. Obviously, a national emergency response agency will build up capabilities, experience, and resources to be able to move into different places and to work with local authorities, state authorities across a number of states for a vigorous and timely response. And as you may remember, there was this sort of joke about the man in charge of FEMA, a guy named Michael Brown. President Bush, who, as you say, was on one of his many vacations, had simply praised Brown and said this sort of now famous heck of a job brownie, and that was sort of it. And then people sort of laughed at this man, but I mean, of course, this was this horrific and very, very sad event, nothing to laugh at. And so I said, well, why is this guy Brownie, who seemed to be so incompetent, so sort of out of his depth, so to speak, why was he even running this agency? And much to my disappointment, and yet I guess I wasn't all that surprised, the media, and as you know, Gary, because I've been on your show many times, this is a constant refrain that I have, the media wasn't asking those questions. They were perfectly happy with the most superficial storylines imaginable. And I'm not going to just pick on the mainstream media, but I mean all the media, all your favorite conservative or liberal or left publications, none of them really dug into this thing at all. There was no investigative effort to get to the bottom of this. And so I got this assignment from Vanity Fair, and I spent several months digging into Brownie and why he was at the head of this agency bobbling this thing. And in the end, Vanity Fair, as many big magazines do, they over-assign pieces. This one was accepted, and they were all ready to run it, and they just never got around to running it. I can't tell you why, but I eventually took it back, and with my frustration with conventional media, I started what became our news site, whowhatwhy.org, we've just rerun that piece. I ran it a number of years ago. We've just rerun it last week, a five-part series on Who, What, Why. And what the article shows, Gary, is that couple of things. Number one, and I think this is probably the biggest story, the Bush administration basically didn't want FEMA to be successful. The Bush administration wanted to destroy FEMA. They wanted to get rid of FEMA, just as a lot of these administrations have, as particularly when they've been candidates, they talk about shutting down things like the Department of Education. They supposedly don't want any big government, and so they really wanted to shut FEMA down. And as you pointed out, Carter created FEMA. They put in some competent people. Going through the history, George H.W. Bush went to cronyism. That's the father of George W. Bush, and put in the neighbor of his chief of staff, John Sununu, who did not have good qualifications. Clinton came in and put in a very strong person, the head of emergency preparedness for the state of Arkansas, which has seen its share of disasters, and he was regarded as excellent. In fact, when Clinton left office and Bush came in, you even saw some powerful Republican senators asking that this man be kept on. But the Bush administration said no, and they got rid of him. And what they did was they brought in cronies, and they brought in first a man named Joe Albaugh. And in this five-part series on whowhatwhy.org, I go into who was Joe Albaugh and why was he put at the head of FEMA. And Joe Albaugh was a strange and mysterious man with alleged intelligence connections, who was a reasonably low-level apparatchik, was mysteriously brought into George W. Bush's gubernatorial campaign as a kind of an enforcer and a man who was supposed to make problems go away, an intimidating force. He then became Bush's campaign manager, and when Bush was elected president, they didn't want him in the White House for some reason, and they were looking to shunt him off, and he ended up, I guess, choosing to head FEMA. And he went in there, and the first thing he did was he began firing all the best people, just gutting the place. Anybody who was well-regarded, he got rid of. They were threats to him, began bringing in his own cronies. And one of the cronies he brought in was a guy named Michael Brown. Now, the news report said that Brown and Albaugh had been college roommates and that this was supposed to be a satisfactory explanation of how Michael Brown got in there. Well, it wasn't, because as I dug into this thing, I discovered they weren't college roommates. In fact, there were no real indications how they even knew each other. And eventually, what I discovered, Gary, was this whole subterranean world where Joe Albaugh and Michael Brown were these sort of low-level kind of Republican hitmen who were used by the father, by George H.W. Bush, to help out big donors and get rid of people who were problems for them and so forth. And they would be placed in these various positions to sort of do mischief, essentially. And those are the two guys you have at the head of America's disaster response after 9/11. This is important. This is after 9/11, these are the guys running the place. And so when FEMA was absorbed into the Department of Homeland Security, Albaugh, seeing that he could not do whatever he wanted there, got out. And he took this brownie, this guy who was his last major job, the highest job he ever had before he was the head of disaster response for all of America, was working for a Arabian horse association where they had contests based on cosmetic factors largely, and Michael Brown was brought in to sort of look at, into the judges of these horse contests. Now, you know, you can't make something like this up. It's just staggering, but there he was at the helm of FEMA, and basically what I document in our five-part series on whowhatwhy.org is that Joe Allbaugh bailed out, put Brownie in charge, and began trying to cash in. Became a consultant, a lobbyist for big companies that wanted contracts. And even before the hurricane hit, Allbaugh was already out there arranging cleanup contracts for these various outfits, small and large, of varying degrees of capability, and making out like a bandit. And there was Michael Brown on the other end ready to help him out. And that is the backstory of Katrina that we never heard.
Let's go a step further. There were a lot of other problems with Katrina that made it worse. For example, when I was down, and I've been down seven times to the lower wards, and I've spoken with well over 1,000 individuals, they tell me that they were told not to worry, that the levees would protect them. And I said, but you knew you were 6 to 9 feet below sea level at that point. And those levees could not possibly withstand a Category 5. So why didn't you just get on a bus or car or any way you could? You could have walked out and gotten out of there. And the most common excuse I've heard is we believe the authorities. Talk about the levees. Talk about the canal that was built around New Orleans that acted like a great surge barrier, a surge enhancer, and the fact that the way New Orleans sits, there is no way in the world you could not have a disaster, and all that was man-made, including the removal of the barrier islands, which could have taken it down almost one full notch from a Category 5 to a Category 4 to Category 3 to a Category 2. Your thoughts, please.
Well, you're absolutely right. I suspect with your experience and having been down there as much as you have, you may know more about that facet than I do. So I'll just say a few things. One thing is that even with the way that they have subsequently built up the protective barriers, I am seeing claims that they're still not adequate. And a lot of this gets into the politics of the Army Corps of Engineers and the stakes involved politically for the contractors. I think it's somewhat complicated, but I absolutely agree that one of the main problems there was these false and dangerous assertions being made that people were okay. They very much got mixed messages. And, you know, when you're poor and when you know, not everybody there have vehicles, the other issues. And then, of course, it became physically difficult, even if you did at some point, and you know this, it became very difficult to even get out of there. This is really leaving extremely vulnerable people on their own. And I remember from that period how mixed the messages were. And you know what? You know, all those people who criticize the folks in New Orleans and say that it was their own fault and their own problem are the same people who have lived through other things in their own area where there was advice that those people get out and many chose to stay. We see this again and again and again in our country's history that very often, here I am in New York City, we've been warned again and again about major problems here and maybe we should get out of the city and people don't go.
You're right. Now, I want to deal with something that Naomi Klein's shock doctrine mentioned. What I see in the case of Katrina was disaster capitalism and government contracts that you alluded to being given to unqualified firms to deal with cleanup efforts and infrastructure repairs. We currently see that in Afghanistan, where $109 billion in infrastructure work was not done, or what was done poorly, or was paid for at an astronomically inflated rate, all corrupt. And then speak on Katrina and how this disaster capitalism work down there and how it relates to the privatizing social and environmental conditions that the government could probably handle better, such as a viable FEMA department that we need, and also what were some of the other disasters Bush's FEMA and his administration created during and after Katrina?
Well, there's so many of them, and I have to say, I mean, I wrote this series years ago, and I, after all of these years, I don't remember all of the particulars perhaps as well as I once did. But we saw again and again, let me just give you a couple of examples. They brought in a company that had screwed up badly in hurricanes in Florida and elsewhere, considerable corruption and incompetence, and yet they were perfectly willing to bring them in. There also was the example when people were stranded, of course, with the hurricane, there was water everywhere, but it wasn't drinking water. In fact, there was no drinking water. And so one of the most important things that you can do in the aftermath of a disaster is provide clean drinking water. And in our series on Who, What, Why, I go into that example. The Clinton administration had a contract with Nestle, which owns many of the biggest brands of bottled water with which we're familiar. And, you know, it makes sense that if you need a huge capacity, you go with a big outfit. And the Bush administration canceled the contract with Nestle. I remember talking to the Nestle executives about that. They were just bewildered because they gave it to this little outfit that was tied in with the Republican Party through, they also had a gun company, and they were very involved with the NRA, which Dick Cheney was very involved with, and Joe Albaugh, I think both of them spoke at the NRA conference. And so there were these other threads, and so this little outfit decided to get in the water business, but they were not really in the water business. They had no experience, and they had no capability. And guess what happened during Katrina? This company, which could not deliver the water, ended up going back to Nestle and basically begging them to help them.
Didn't know about that one. I want to read something to you here. It's this just came out this morning. This is from Climate News. Quote, the risks of new Katrinas rises as climate warms. Climate change may dramatically increase the risk of simultaneous cyclones and storm surges striking populous coastlines around the world. Perfect storms are by definition improbable, but climate scientists now think that the developing situation of combining extreme tropical cyclones and unprecedented storm surges is going to get a whole lot less improbable. And the chances that a city like Tampa in Florida will be hit by a devastating hurricane and an 11-meter wall of ocean water could be an increase by 1,400%, according to the article in Nature, Climate Change. And, quote, all climate modeling involves a calculation of probabilities. And they're looking at all the probabilities, and they're looking at how bad it's going to get. And then, so we have that. Then we also have scientists from Princeton, MIT, and the University of California. They did what is called Risks of New Katrinas, and it lays out the advances in making predictions for cyclones. And by the way, right now, for the first time in recorded history, there's three giant cyclones in the Pacific Ocean, and you also have the largest segment of the Pacific Ocean ever recorded that has a huge increase in temperature. And that is, we're talking about something over 1,000 miles long, and that is affecting all aquatic life that cannot adapt to it. But also we have the biggest El Nino in history raging out there. And so what at one time would have been considered very rare, highly improbable, now we have to look very honestly that we're going to be hit with a lot of Category 5 storms in our future, and we had better pay attention to preparedness, not just at the federal level, but what can we do individually to prepare in case the government or its agencies are not prepared. And that also was shown when Hurricane Sandy hit New York. They did not have the portable generators. They had over 100 sitting in warehouses. They didn't have the water that people needed. I was taking a truckload of water. I bought a whole tractor trailer with a water and was taking it downtown to Lower Manhattan where there was no water and no electricity each day. I shouldn't have to be doing that. The federal government should be doing that. But it's like the bureaucracy just doesn't move in a timely or proper way. Your final thoughts, please.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I just want to pull back to the issue of climate denial, because what you're really looking at is these vested interests. And by the way, as you know, I'm the author of the book about the Bush family, Family of Secrets, and I've studied the way that they operate. Now you've got another Bush, Jeb, running for president. He's just received $1 million from one of the key people in the coal industry. These people, along with the Koch brothers, are the ones that are very effectively convincing a large percentage of our public that there is no such thing as climate change. They are preventing us from doing something individually or collectively about this looming disaster for all of humanity. And you're absolutely right that these things are going to get worse and worse. And at the same time, these are the same people who convince us, don't trust government, defund government. Government has no role in any of these things. So they are basically selling us chaos. And what can we do as individuals? I think we need to be active in studying the disinformation mechanism that paralyzes us and prevents us from taking action. I would argue, as the founder of Who, What, Why, which is a nonprofit investigative news outfit, that the first thing we need to do before we can take action is we need to have accurate information. We need trusted sources of information so we can really know what is going on. And I salute you and your radio show for being part of the better media. I think we need a lot more of that. And as I like to say, first the information, then the action.
I appreciate that, Russ. Thank you for all the good work you're doing at Who, What, Why, and for reminding us from long ago, 10 years ago, what didn't have to happen and shouldn't in the future, but likely will if we don't become more diligent. Russ Baker, thank you very much for being with us. And to all of you listening, thank you. Look forward to sharing more on tomorrow's program. Have a nice day. Disappear.